A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about SSRIs and whether we've been wrong to treat them as basically interchangeable. Prozac hangs around forever. Lexapro is supposedly the purest serotonin player. There's one that's weirdly good for OCD, but people otherwise avoid. And then you've got Reddit anecdotes about ADHD patients responding to SSRIs that aren't supposed to touch ADHD at all. The real question is, how homogeneous is this drug class, actually? And if drug development is shifting away from pure serotonin toward messier profiles that hit dopamine and norepinephrine, does the whole category of SSRI just dissolve into something else? Let's talk about the current lineup, how similar they really are to each other, and what comes next.
This is one of those questions where the answer starts with, well, they are homogeneous, and then immediately turns into, except in every way that actually matters clinically. The thing that unites them is the mechanism in the name, selective serotonin reuptake inhibition. They all block the serotonin transporter, SERT-T. That's the headline. But the selectivity part, that's where things get interesting, because selective is relative, and the degree of selectivity varies enormously across the group.
They all do the same thing, just some of them do other things on the side.
And those side activities aren't just trivia. They explain why you'd pick one over another for a specific patient. Let me lay out the main cast. You've got six classic SSRIs that most people mean when they say the term fluoxetine, that's Prozac. And escitalopram, Lexapro, which is basically the purified active half of citalopram. Then you've got a few later entries that blur the boundaries. Vortioxetine, sold as Trintellix or Brintellix depending on where you are, which is technically an SSRI but also does a whole lot of receptor-level tinkering. And vilazodone, Vibrid, which pairs reuptake inhibition with direct partial agonism at a serotonin receptor.
Purified active half. That's an interesting phrase. What does that actually mean?
Citalopram is what's called a racemic mixture. It contains two mirror image molecules, think left hand and right hand. One of them, the S enantiomer, does essentially all the therapeutic work. The other one, the R enantiomer, doesn't just sit there inert. It may actually interfere somewhat with the S enantiomer's binding. So Lundbeck, the manufacturer, isolated the active half, called it escitalopram, and got a drug that's more potent milligram for milligram and possibly has a slightly cleaner side effect profile. It's the decaf espresso of SSRIs. Same mechanism, less noise.
The decaf espresso that costs more because someone had to do extra work to remove something.
That's the pharmaceutical industry in five words. But here's where the homogeneity question gets real. Let's talk binding affinities. All SSRIs bind to SERT. That's the serotonin transporter. But they also bind, with varying degrees of enthusiasm, to other receptors and transporters. Paroxetine, for example, is the least selective of the bunch. It has meaningful anticholinergic activity. It blocks muscarinic acetylcholine receptors. That's why it's the SSRI most likely to cause dry mouth, constipation, cognitive fogginess, and why it's the one you really don't want to stop abruptly. The withdrawal syndrome with paroxetine is notoriously brutal, partly because of that cholinergic rebound.
That's the one that's particularly used for OCD?
No, that's actually fluvoxamine. Fluvoxamine has a fascinating profile. It's an SSRI, yes, but it's also a pretty potent sigma-1 receptor agonist. Sigma-1 receptors are these mysterious proteins in the endoplasmic reticulum that seem to be involved in cellular stress responses, neuroplasticity, and possibly inflammation regulation. Fluvoxamine's affinity for sigma-1 is unique among SSRIs. It binds there at concentrations you actually achieve clinically. Other SSRIs either don't touch sigma-1 or only do so at concentrations you never reach in a human brain.
Sigma-1 agonism does what for OCD exactly?
That's the thing we don't fully know. The evidence that fluvoxamine is particularly good for OCD is more clinical than mechanistic. It performed well in OCD trials, got the indication, and clinicians noticed it seemed to help patients who hadn't responded to other SSRIs. Whether Sigma-1 is the reason is still debated. What we do know is that Sigma-1 receptors modulate glutamate signaling, calcium regulation, and have neuroprotective effects. There's a whole separate research thread about fluvoxamine and COVID. Early in the pandemic, some observational data suggested it reduced hospitalization risk, possibly through Sigma-1-mediated anti-inflammatory effects. That got a lot of attention, though the evidence never quite solidified into a clear treatment recommendation.
You've got one SSRI that's secretly also an anticholinergic, another that's moonlighting as a Sigma-1 agonist, and then there's Prozac with its marathon half-life. What's the clinical significance of that half-life difference?
It's enormous in practice. Fluoxetine's half-life is roughly 4 to 6 days for the parent drug, and its active metabolite, norfluoxetine, has a half-life of up to 16 days. That means when you stop fluoxetine, it takes weeks, sometimes over a month, to fully clear your system. Compare that to paroxetine or fluvoxamine, with half-lives around 15 to 22 hours. If you miss a dose of paroxetine, you might feel it by the next day. Miss a dose of fluoxetine, your brain barely notices.
Which makes Prozac the self-tapering antidepressant.
That's exactly how clinicians think about it. If you have a patient who's disorganized or tends to stop medications abruptly, or you're worried about discontinuation syndrome, fluoxetine is your friend. It basically tapers itself. On the flip side, if someone has a bad reaction, you're waiting a long time for it to wash out. And if you're switching from fluoxetine to another serotonergic drug, you need a long washout period, sometimes 5 weeks, to avoid serotonin syndrome. That's a real constraint.
What about Lexapro's claim to being the purest? Is that marketing or pharmacology?
There's truth to it. Escitalopram has the highest selectivity for SERT versus other monoamine transporters of any SSRI. Its affinity for the norepinephrine transporter and the dopamine transporter is negligible at clinical doses. It also has minimal binding to histamine receptors, muscarinic receptors, and most other off-target sites. If what you want is a drug that does exactly one thing, block serotonin reuptake, and nothing else, escitalopram is about as close as we've gotten. The clinical correlate is that it tends to be well-tolerated, with relatively low rates of the side effects that come from off-target binding.
We've got a spectrum. On one end, escitalopram, the laser-focused serotonin purist. On the other, something like paroxetine, the pharmacological equivalent of buckshot, hitting multiple systems. And in between, sertraline, which I think also has some dopamine activity.
Yes, and this is one of those Reddit anecdotes made real. Sertraline is unique among SSRIs in having modest but measurable dopamine transporter inhibition. It's weak, much weaker than its SERT binding, but it's there. It also has some Sigma-1 binding, though less than fluvoxamine. This slightly broader profile might explain why some clinicians reach for sertraline when there's a hint of attention deficit or low energy alongside the depression. It's not an ADHD treatment. The dopamine effect is too modest for that, but it might nudge things in a direction that helps certain patients. The flip side is that sertraline can be more activating, more likely to cause initial anxiety or insomnia than some of the more sedating SSRIs.
Which brings us to the forum. Reports. People saying an SSRI helped their ADHD when it's not supposed to. Are those just noise, or is there a pharmacological basis for some of these responses?
A bit of both. Part of it is that depression and ADHD have overlapping symptoms. Poor concentration, low motivation, executive dysfunction. Treat the depression, and the cognitive symptoms improve regardless of whether the underlying architecture is ADHD. That's the boring explanation. The more interesting one is that serotonin and dopamine systems aren't cleanly separated in the brain. Serotonin neurons in the raphe nuclei project to the prefrontal cortex and modulate dopamine release there. Some SSRIs, by increasing serotonin tone, indirectly affect dopamine signaling in the frontal lobes. It's not a direct hit on the dopamine transporter, but it's real. An individual variation in receptor distribution, transporter density, metabolic enzymes, all of that means two people can take the same drug and have meaningfully different neurochemical responses.
The idea of a homogeneous drug class is true at the level of the primary mechanism and false at the level of what actually happens inside a specific person's brain.
It connects directly to the second part of the prompt, the question about whether future development will move beyond serotonin toward messier profiles targeting dopamine and norepinephrine, and whether the discrete SSRI category will just fade away.
Which I suspect you have thoughts about.
I have many thoughts about this. Let's start with what's already happened. The clean, single neurotransmitter era peaked with escitalopram. Since then, the trend has been toward precisely the kind of nuanced multi-target pharmacology the prompt describes. Look at vortioxetine. It's classified as an SSRI. It blocks SERT, but it's also a 5-HT1A agonist, a 5-HT1B partial agonist, and an antagonist at 5-HT1D, 5-HT3, and 5-HT7 receptors. That's five different serotonin receptor subtypes. It's modulating on top of reuptake inhibition. The clinical rationale was that just blocking SERT increases serotonin everywhere, which is a blunt instrument. Some of that extra serotonin hits receptors you want stimulated, and some hits receptors where stimulation actually causes side effects or even works against the antidepressant effect. Vortioxetine tries to steer the serotonin signal, boost it at the receptors associated with mood and cognition, block it at the receptors associated with nausea and sexual dysfunction.
The musical equivalent of not just turning up the volume, but adjusting the equalizer.
And the cognitive data for vortioxetine is genuinely interesting. It's the only antidepressant with a specific FDA-approved claim about improving processing speed, an actual cognitive metric, not just a mood metric. Whether that's clinically meaningful in the real world is debated, but the signal is there. Similar philosophy, different execution. Bilazodone pairs SERT inhibition with direct partial agonism at 5-HT1A. 5-HT1. A agonism is thought to accelerate the onset of antidepressant effect. One of the theories about why SSRIs take weeks to work is that you need to wait for autoreceptors to downregulate and directly stimulating postsynaptic 5-HT1. I might bypass some of that delay. In practice, vilazodone didn't revolutionize onset time, but it does seem to have a somewhat lower sexual side effect burden, which was one of the goals.
Then there's the one that's not even pretending to be an SSRI anymore, Auvelity, which I've seen mentioned recently.
Auvelity is fascinating, and it's the clearest signal of where things are heading. It was approved by the FDA in August of 2022. It's a combination of dextromethorphan and bupropion in a single pill. Dextromethorphan, yes, the cough suppressant, is an NMDA receptor antagonist, similar in mechanism to ketamine, and also a sigma-1 agonist, and also an SERT inhibitor. Bupropion is an NDRI, norepinephrine and dopamine reuptake inhibitor. But in this combination, its main job is to inhibit the liver enzyme CYP2D6, which breaks down dextromethorphan. So bupropion essentially boosts dextromethorphan levels and extends its half-life. You're getting glutamatergic modulation, sigma-1 agonism, serotonin reuptake inhibition, and norepinephrine and dopamine reuptake inhibition, all from two generic drugs combined in a novel way.
It's an SSRI, an NDRI, an NMDA antagonist, and a sigma-1 agonist all at once. That's not a drug class. That's a pharmacological potluck.
A potluck that showed significant antidepressant effects within 1 week in its pivotal trials. The rapid onset is the headline. Traditional SSRIs take 4 to 6 weeks for full effect. Auvelity showed separation from placebo at week 1. That's a meaningful clinical difference.
Which raises the question, if the future is multi-mechanism drugs that hit glutamate, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin all at once, does it even make sense to talk about SSRIs as a category anymore?
I think the category becomes historical rather than clinical. It'll be like talking about first-generation antihistamines, still a useful reference point, still some drugs in that category that get prescribed, but not where the action is. The term SSRI will describe a mechanism, not a therapeutic strategy. And we're already seeing this in the research pipeline. There's a lot of interest in triple reuptake inhibitors, drugs that block SERT, NET, and DAT simultaneously, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine transporters. The idea is appealing. Instead of layering an SSRI with bupropion or a stimulant, have one molecule do all three. The problem has been getting the ratios right. You want enough dopamine effect to help with anhedonia and motivation, but not so much that you create abuse liability or psychosis risk. The early triple reuptake candidates either had too much dopamine activity and raised addiction concerns, or too little and didn't differentiate from existing SNRIs.
SNRIs being the serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, venlafaxine, duloxetine, that family.
And SNRIs themselves were the first step away from the pure serotonin model. The logic was that adding norepinephrine would capture patients who didn't respond to serotonin alone and would help with physical symptoms of depression, pain, fatigue, that kind of thing. Duloxetine got an FDA indication for chronic pain conditions on top of depression. But SNRIs are still fundamentally in the reuptake inhibitor paradigm. The newer drugs are breaking out of that entirely.
What does the next decade actually look like? Are we going to see SSRIs disappear from prescribing?
No, and for a few reasons. First, they work for a lot of people. Somewhere between 40 and 60% of patients get a meaningful response from a first-line SSRI. That's not perfect, but it's not nothing. Second, they're generic and cheap. Fluoxetine costs pennies a day. Auvelity, as a branded combination, is going to be expensive and require prior authorizations. Third, we have decades of safety data on SSRIs. We know what they do over the long term. A novel glutamatergic agent? We're still learning. Ketamine and esketamine have been transformative for some patients, but we're still figuring out the optimal dosing frequency, the long-term cognitive effects, the bladder toxicity issues. So SSRIs aren't going anywhere. But their share of the market, and their share of the research attention, will shrink.
There's also something about the way drug classes shape clinical thinking that's worth examining. When you have a category called SSRI, it suggests a kind of interchangeability. If one SSRI doesn't work, try another. Same mechanism, different molecule, maybe you get lucky. Is that actually evidence-based?
The evidence on switching within class versus switching between classes is mixed, but the clinical practice is widespread and it's not unreasonable. The STAR-D trial, that's the Sequence Treatment Alternatives to Relieve Depression study, a massive NIMH-funded trial from the mid-2000s, found that among patients who didn't respond to citalopram, about 25% remitted when switched to another SSRI, sertraline. About the same percentage remitted when switched to venlafaxine, an SNRI, or bupropion, an NDRI. The takeaway wasn't that within-class switching is useless. It's that a meaningful minority of people who don't respond to one SSRI will respond to another, and the odds aren't dramatically different from switching to a different class entirely.
Which is pharmacologically puzzling, right? If the mechanism is the same, why would switching help?
Because the mechanism isn't actually the same. That's the whole point of this conversation. The differences in off-target binding, in metabolite profiles, in half-lives, in how individual patients metabolize different drugs through different CYP enzymes, all of that creates meaningful variation in what actually reaches the brain and what it does when it gets there. Two people on the same dose of the same SSRI can have tenfold differences in plasma levels because one is a CYP2D6 poor metabolizer and the other is an ultra-rapid metabolizer. Switch to a drug metabolized by a different enzyme, and suddenly you're in the therapeutic window. That's not a difference in mechanism. It's a difference in pharmacokinetics. But to the patient, it's the difference between this drug doesn't work and this drug works.
Pharmacogenomics, the promise that we just test your liver enzymes and pick the right drug, has been just around the corner for, what, 20 years now?
And it's made some progress. There are commercial pharmacogenomic panels now that will tell you whether you're a poor, intermediate, extensive, or ultra-rapid metabolizer for various CYP enzymes. The evidence that using these panels improves outcomes is still frustratingly thin. A few studies show modest benefits, others show no difference. Part of the problem is that plasma levels of SSRIs correlate only loosely with clinical response. There's a therapeutic window, but it's wide and fuzzy. And the bigger problem is that depression isn't just a serotonin deficiency, so optimizing serotonin transporter occupancy only gets you so far.
That's the deeper question lurking under all of this. The entire SSRI enterprise rests on the monoamine hypothesis, the idea that depression involves deficiencies in serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine signaling, and fixing those deficiencies fixes the depression. But that hypothesis has been under assault for years. What's the current state of play?
The monoamine hypothesis in its simple form, depression is low serotonin, has been dead for a while. Nobody serious believes that anymore. What's replaced it is more nuanced. The current thinking is that monoamine systems are involved in depression, but they're downstream of something else, or their modulatory systems that regulate broader brain networks involved in mood, stress response, and cognition. The neuroplasticity hypothesis, which has gained a lot of ground, says that depression is fundamentally a disorder of impaired plasticity, the brain's ability to adapt, rewire, and grow new connections in response to experience. Stress shrinks the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex, reduces BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and impairs synaptic connectivity. Effective treatments, whether pharmacological or behavioral, seem to restore plasticity. SSRIs increase BDNF expression. Electroconvulsive therapy increases BDNF. Ketamine triggers a burst of synaptic growth. Exercise increases BDNF. They all converge on plasticity enhancement, even though they start from completely different mechanisms.
Serotonin isn't the cause of depression. It's one of several levers you can pull to get the plasticity machinery running again.
That's the emerging view, and it explains a lot of otherwise puzzling observations. Why do SSRIs take weeks to work if they increase serotonin within hours? Because the therapeutic effect isn't the serotonin increase, it's the downstream neuroplastic changes that the serotonin increase gradually induces. Why do completely different mechanisms, serotonin reuptake inhibition, NMDA antagonism, electroconvulsive therapy, all end up treating depression? Because they all converge on restoring plasticity. Why does talk therapy produce brain changes that look similar to medication-induced changes? Because learning and experience are themselves plasticity drivers.
Which means the future of antidepressant development might not be about serotonin versus dopamine versus norepinephrine at all. It might be about finding the most efficient, tolerable way to trigger plasticity.
That's where things like psychedelics enter the picture. Psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, is a 5-HT2A agonist. It directly stimulates a serotonin receptor, but it's not a reuptake inhibitor. It produces a rapid, profound, and in some studies sustained antidepressant effect, possibly by inducing a state of heightened plasticity, what some researchers call a critical period, where the brain is unusually malleable. MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, same idea, different receptor targets. These aren't daily medications that maintain a steady state. They're intermittent interventions that open a window of plasticity, ideally paired with psychotherapy to guide the brain toward healthier patterns.
The future looks less like take this pill every morning to correct your serotonin deficiency, and more like undergo this targeted intervention that temporarily makes your brain more adaptable, and use that window to build new patterns.
Yes, and that's a fundamentally different model of psychiatric treatment. It blurs the line between pharmacology and psychotherapy in a way that the current system, which separates medication management from therapy into different appointments with different providers, isn't really set up to handle. The integration challenge is going to be enormous.
Let me pull us back to something concrete, because I think listeners who are on SSRIs or considering them might be wondering, given everything we've said about the differences between these drugs, how do you actually choose? If you're a clinician staring at a patient who needs an SSRI, what's the decision tree?
It's alarmingly pragmatic. You start with the side effect profile that the patient is most worried about. If they're terrified of weight gain, you might avoid paroxetine, which has the strongest weight gain signal. If they have significant anxiety with their depression, you might lean toward an SSRI with more sedation, paroxetine or fluvoxamine, or one with strong anxiety data like sertraline. If they're already on multiple medications, you think about drug-drug interactions. Fluoxetine and paroxetine are potent CYP2D6 inhibitors and can mess with the metabolism of other drugs. Fluoxetine inhibits CYC2C19 as well. Citalopram and escitalopram are relatively clean on the interaction front. If they've responded to a particular SSRI in the past, or a family member has, you use that. If cost is an issue, you go generic. Fluoxetine, sertraline, citalopram are all dirt cheap. If they have cardiac issues, you're careful with citalopram, which has an FDA warning about QT prolongation at higher doses.
QT prolongation being a heart rhythm thing.
Right. It can predispose to a dangerous arrhythmia called torsades de pointes. Escitalopram seems to have less of this effect, which is one of the reasons it's often preferred over citalopram despite being more expensive. And then there's the discontinuation issue. If you have a patient who's likely to stop abruptly, intentionally or not, you really want to avoid paroxetine and venlafaxine, which have the worst withdrawal syndromes. Fluoxetine's long half-life makes it the most forgiving.
It's striking how much of this is about managing downsides rather than targeting upsides. You're not picking the drug most likely to work. You're picking the drug least likely to cause problems for this particular patient.
That's a fair characterization, and it reflects the uncomfortable reality that we can't predict efficacy well. The number needed to treat for SSRIs, the number of patients you need to treat for one to achieve remission, is somewhere around 5 to 7, depending on the study. That means most patients don't achieve remission on any given SSRI. But the side effect profiles are more predictable, so you optimize what you can optimize and hope efficacy follows.
Which brings us to the final part of the prompt. Will this discrete drug class and others like it fade away? I think the answer is that the category becomes less clinically useful over time, even if the drugs themselves stick around.
I put it this way. The SSRI category was useful because it described a clear mechanism that differentiated these drugs from their predecessors, the tricyclics and MAOIs. Tricyclics were messy, hit everything, and could kill you in overdose. SSRIs were cleaner, safer, and you could explain the mechanism in one sentence. That mattered for marketing, for prescribing confidence, for patient acceptance. But as the newer drugs get messier in a smarter way, multi-target, rationally designed to hit specific receptor subtypes while avoiding others, the clean category distinctions break down. Is vortioxetine an SSRI? Technically, yes, but calling it that obscures more than it reveals. Is Auvelity an SSRI? It contains an SSRI component, but its most interesting mechanism is probably the NMDA antagonism. The categories are becoming less useful as descriptors.
The pharmaceutical equivalent of genre and music, rock band, meant something clear in 1975. In 2026, you've got artists pulling from 5 different traditions, and the genre label tells you almost nothing about what the thing actually sounds like.
And just like in music, the blurring of categories is a sign of maturation, not decay. We're past the point where increases serotonin is a sufficient description of what an antidepressant does or how it works. The future drugs are going to be harder to summarize, harder to categorize, and hopefully more effective for the substantial minority of patients who don't respond to what we have now.
One thing we haven't touched on, the prompt mentioned that development of these drugs seems to have decelerated. Is that accurate? Because from where I'm sitting, it looks like there's been a lot happening.
The perception of deceleration is real, and it's partly because several major pharmaceutical companies pulled out of psychiatric drug development in the 2010s. The reason was simple. The drugs are hard to develop, the trials are expensive and have high failure rates, and the generics market makes it hard to recoup investment. Why spend $1 billion developing a novel antidepressant when you can develop an oncology drug with a clearer biomarker and better reimbursement? The ROI calculus shifted. But what's happened in the last 5 years is that smaller biotech companies and academic researchers have stepped into the gap, and the science has gotten more interesting. The ketamine revival, the psychedelics renaissance, the neurosteroid drugs like brexanolone and zuranolone for postpartum depression, these are genuine innovations, even if they're not coming from the traditional big pharma players.
Zuranolone. That's the one that's basically a 14-day oral course rather than a chronic daily medication, right?
Yes, approved in 2023 for postpartum depression and then for major depressive disorder. It's a neuroactive steroid, a synthetic version of allopregnanolone, which modulates GABA, a receptors. Completely different mechanism from SSRIs. And the treatment model is different. A 2-week course that's supposed to produce a rapid response, after which you stop and monitor. Whether the response is durable is still being studied, but the concept is a departure from the take this indefinitely model of SSRIs.
The future isn't just new molecules, it's new treatment paradigms. Intermittent interventions, plasticity windows, short courses rather than maintenance.
That's exciting, but it also creates new problems. How do you bill for a 2-week treatment course in a system built around monthly medication management visits? How do you integrate psychotherapy with a drug that's only effective during a specific window? How do you train clinicians who spent their careers thinking in terms of chronic daily dosing? The pharmacology is racing ahead of the implementation science.
It sounds like the SSRI era, roughly 1990 to 2025, will be remembered as the age when we thought we'd figured depression out, only to realize we'd just built a better hammer and started seeing everything as a nail.
A better hammer is not nothing. SSRIs have helped millions of people. They're safer than what came before, they're well understood, and they're accessible. But yes, the next era is about recognizing that depression isn't one thing, serotonin isn't the whole story, and the future of treatment is going to be more personalized, more mechanistically diverse, and harder to fit into neat categories.
Which, as someone who enjoys categories, I find mildly annoying. But as someone who enjoys people not being depressed, I'll take it.
That's the right attitude.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, researchers mistakenly attributed the remarkable tensile strength of a spider silk sample collected near the Aral Sea Basin to a unique crystalline protein structure. The finding was cited widely for over a decade before a follow-up study in 1985 revealed the silk had been contaminated with microscopic mineral fibers from the collecting equipment. The spider in question was producing perfectly ordinary silk.
For 11 years, the scientific record had super silk because someone didn't clean their equipment properly.
The Aral Sea Basin, giving us one of the great ecological disasters of the 20th century and, apparently, a phantom arachnid marvel. That feels about right.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or search for us on Spotify. We'll be back with a new one soon.
See you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.